hosts, the heavens, when we think about the sky and the stars above us, likely we think back to those first opportunities we had as kids, maybe sitting on our back porch with our grandmother, watching the moon rise. Maybe on those dark nights when we were out camping with friends or with family, and we realized, away from the city lights, how many stars there really were in the heavens. Maybe you, like myself, remember the times anxiously awaiting a meteor shower, sitting out in the backyard on pallets with your family, having that sweet, juicy watermelon that you're working on, and watching and waiting for those shooting stars, those meteors to come in. All the while, we're in awe of those twinkling jewels that we find up in the heavens. They seem to multiply the longer we look. The more time we're out there and our eyes become adjusted and we become more steadfast in our watching, it seems that they pop out of almost nowhere. Some are big and bright, some are small and faint. Some are blue and some are orange. Some are clustered together real tight into groups, and some seem to be all alone in the space by themselves. Their variety and their number simply amazes us. But there's far more than just the number of stars in our cosmos that is amazing. And I would imagine that the question was in the back of your mind as you were viewing and as you were thinking about the heavens at various times. The question: what is beyond the stars? What is beyond the stars? Well, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked it. And since you've asked it, I want you to come on a tour with me. I want to be your guide. I want to talk to you and show you that there is an amazing universe beyond the stars. Now, this isn't the type of tour that you might... Oh, and all the text is jumbled on that screen. I apologize. I don't want this to be a tour like when you went to D.C. or your summer trip in New York or Gatlinburg, wherever you went. I don't want it to be a tour that you sit back, the tour guide talks for a while, you sip your raspberry lemonade, and the day just, you know, flitters by. I want this to be a tour that you are engaged with me. I need you to follow along and to watch, and I will talk about God's design in the universe. This image that you have before us, starting off our tour on the largest of scales, this image was taken by a satellite looking at infrared light. And when it looked up at the sky, it surveyed the entire sky. It was an all-sky survey. It's a strange layout to this plot, but it's actually, I believe, it's an Atoff projection. It's a way of visualizing the entire sky onto a two-dimensional grid. And what you see is that... Oh, I apologize. What you see is there's a huge number of dots. But what I want you to think about is that every one of those dots is not a star. Every one of those dots is another galaxy. And for those who may have been far removed from their earth science and physical science classes, the galaxy is not a single star, is not a single planet. It is a collection of millions, of billions of stars themselves. So this plot, which contains about 1.6 million galaxies, shows us a glimpse of what is beyond the stars. You noticed a little yellow square. That yellow square was on sort of the darkest, blankest part of that map that I could kind of visually locate. The image that you have now before you is called the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. The scientists at Hubble decided that what they wanted to do was they wanted to see what was at the extent, what was the farthest that they could look at, what would exist there. So they found an area that was basically devoid of any known object. And they spent 1.5 to 2 million seconds. I believe that's somewhere in the range of 20 days, looking at this one blank spot. And that's what they saw. That image contains approximately 10,000 galaxies in the area of the sky that was supposed to be devoid of any known objects. Now, if you think about that for a moment, a small patch of sky, seemingly devoid, turns up 10,000 galaxies. But that was only one 12.7 millionth of the entire sky. So if we take 10,000 galaxies, multiply it by 12.7 million, we will have the estimate for how many galaxies would be in our universe. Oftentimes I get this question when I go to various places or I talk about astronomy. How many stars? How many galaxies are there? Well, there's no way of cataloging them all. And so when astronomers, astrophysicists put out a number, what they do is they take one or two or a sampling and then they try to extrapolate that across the whole sky. And so this is the best estimate that we can have. 130 billion separate galaxies in our universe. You'll also notice that there's a small yellow square. I don't know if any of you remember sort of a documentary. It was played in schools a lot of time, called The Powers of Ten. Actually, Carl Sagan might have narrated it. I'm not for sure. Done in the 70s. It was this video that took you, trying to tell you and describe to you how to use scientific notation. You know, that funny way of writing numbers where you say something times 10 to the something power. Well, this video took you on steps, and every step increased by a power of 10. And I want to do a similar sort of thing. Every step that I take is going to be at least 1,000 times focusing in. Many of the steps are going to be 1,000,000 times focusing in. Here we have a view of the heavens, a very, very small view, tiny, minuscule. Actually, if you pull out a dime and you take that dime and you hold it at arm's length and you look at that dime, the spot that this image came from would be the size of Roosevelt's eye. That's the portion of the sky that this is imaging. But let's zoom in real quick on that yellow square. You see, that yellow square was around one single galaxy. That galaxy, a spiral type galaxy, which is similar to our own. And so what we have just done is we have gone from the universe, 130 billion galaxies estimated. Now let's bring that in and think about our own galaxy. Have you ever been out in a dark place and seen the Milky Way? That's the name of our galaxy, right? Well, how could you see the Milky Way? How do you see something that you're inside of? Well, you don't exactly, but here is a view that I pulled off of maybe Wikimedia Commons, a site that has lots of images freely available. And this is a photographic shot, and you see the horizon along the bottom. You see maybe some light from where the sun had set much earlier. And you notice that there's that milky stripe running vertical in this image. If you have never seen this milky vertical stripe, I encourage you to find some dark place, maybe the campgrounds around Chiha. Find some place when it's dark and look up, and you will be absolutely amazed. That milky stripe, which the ancient Greeks termed the Milky Way Galaxy, or gave us that name that we now call the Milky Way Galaxy, because there was this patch of sky, this linear patch that stretches across the entire sky from one horizon to the other. And what that tells us is that our galaxy is a disk. We don't sit in a ball-shaped galaxy. We sit in a disk, which is actually important for design, for us to be able to observe the universe. Here are a couple of images. The top image is one of those all-sky images, but this one shows us where the stars are located in our galaxy. Okay, so think about that. The exact same image that we talked about before that had only other galaxies, this one contains stars. It actually shows us a map of our entire sky as you would see it maybe with your own eye. if you were able to see the whole sky at once. You see that there is a definite intensity across that horizontal plane, and that's the disk of our Milky Way galaxy. And so just by a simple observation of our sky where we see this intense stripe of stars, we can deduce that we live in a relatively flat galaxy. The other image in the bottom right is an artist representation of our galaxy, how there are spiral arms. And we get that knowledge, we get that insight in from mapping our own sky and also looking at other galaxies. Spiral galaxies are very common. About half of all galaxies in the universe are of some sort of spiral type, show some sort of structure similar to this. And we find ourselves in that little yellow square. So let's zoom in real fast. Inside of our own galaxy, we have a solar system. The solar system is a system of objects, of particles that revolve around the sun, or sol, S-O-L. Our sun sits at the center, but you know, we're not the only planet, of course, right? There are other planets, but have you ever thought about what else is in our solar system? I know Dr. Faust, and also later on this week when you get to hear Dr. Houts, NASA is very interested and has to be interested in what is in our solar system. If you'll notice on this plot, you'll see there's an inset which is enlarged, and in that enlarged inset there to your left, the dark circles are the orbits of the planets. And so that orange orbit is actually of Jupiter's orbit. The Earth and Venus and Mars and Mercury are inside of that orbit. But do you notice that big donut, that big fluffy region? That's the asteroid belt. And I don't know if you can see it with your eyes. That belt is made up of individual dots. Every one of those dots is a known asteroid. So when we think about our solar system is not just the few planets and now the dwarf planets like Pluto. It's not just those major bodies. It is literally thousands upon thousands, tens, maybe even hundreds of thousands of large particles all in their own orbit, in their own orientation, revolving around our sun along with us. You see, again, there's a little yellow square. Let's zoom in real fast on that. Here we find the planet Saturn. The image you're looking at is probably one of my favorite images. It's a different image. It's not what you expect. When you've seen images of Saturn where there's the bands and the rings, but this one, Saturn's all dark. It's black. The reason is that NASA sent a probe that was orbiting Saturn, scanning the moon, scanning the rings. It happened to pass in the shadow that Saturn cast. So think about maybe on a sunny day, you're out with your little girls or you're out with friends, and the sun happens to come behind a woman's head, and you see this the lighting of the hair around her shoulders and around her head. Here we have Saturn being backlit by the sun. And you see the light from the sun coming around and coming through the rings of Saturn. This is really an amazing image because it was one of the first images where we saw that Saturn actually had another ring. You see that the plane that is very bright that goes around Saturn. Those are the typical rings that we have known about for centuries. But what you may not be able to see with the contrast, there is a faint ring that goes way out to the edge of the image. This faint blue ring that was actually seen and imaged for the first time in this image right here. But something that else is interesting is, do you see that little yellow square? In that little yellow square, if you were able to blow up this image, and you were able to look very closely, there is a pale blue dot. Pale blue dot seen just inside the G ring or through the G ring of Saturn. That pale blue dot is where you are sitting right now. It's the Earth seen from a billion miles away. It's one of the first and few images that we have from the outer solar system looking back at our home planet. Now you get a little bit of the scale. Here we sit on this planet that has a circumference of 24,000 miles. And yet it's simply a pale blue dot from Saturn's perspective. But let's zoom in, and here we are. This is a famous shot by the Apollo 8 astronauts, the first manned orbit of our moon. And something that was truly amazing, even to them, if you go back and you read the transcripts of this event, they were amazed, blown away when they came around the moon in their orbit, and they saw for the first time not a sunrise, not a moonrise, they saw an Earth rise, rising over the lunar surface. 250,000 miles away, 1968, Christmas Eve. Many of you could probably think back and know where you were with family, with friends. You were being imaged from 250,000 miles away. Amazing, amazing. As we zoom in, we have the blue marble, as it's termed, our planet. But when you look at that planet, I want you to think back with me. We have gone all the way from the extent of the whole universe, billions of galaxies, billions of light years wide, vast. We have seen the diversity. We have seen the detail. We have seen the structure. And here, when we look at our planet, we see all of that again. We're not on a huge scale. We're on the Earth scale. But yet, we still see structure. We still see diversity and detail in the cloud systems, in the topography of the land, in the marine and the ocean life, in the currents and in the systems. People spend their entire life modeling one aspect of the currents of the ocean, of the winds, of the tornado systems, of you name it. And yet we find all of that built in, working, processing on our own planet. Did you put it there? Did I put it there? Did the scientists at NASA describe how our Earth ought to exist and operate? That little yellow square that was sitting there in South America was focused on the Amazon. If we zoom in to the canopy of the rainforest, the Amazon rainforest, think back to your biology classes or your ecology classes or any sort of life science classes. When the topic of the rainforest was brought up, what were some of the thoughts? Haven't you heard that there are more species of ants, of beetles, of bugs in that one section of our Earth than practically all the rest? The diversity, the richness of the biological life that exists there is absolutely astounding. As we zoom in maybe to one leaf now, about tens of thousands zooming in, we find here the underside of a sunflower leaf. And notice, again, it's just a simple leaf, right? Look at the detail. Look at the structure. Look how the veins move from the stems. Look how they wrap around the sections. Some of the terminology in describing the anatomy of a leaf talk about the cuticle. Talk about the epidermis, an upper and a lower epidermis. These are things that relate to humans, our complex bodies, but yet when we turn to a leaf, we find that it is so complex we have to use similar terminologies. How it has veins, right, that carry the nutrients and the oxygen and the carbon dioxide. Absolutely amazing. But let's zoom in one more layer. I lived 3 years in Alabama. I know about allergies. I know about pollen grains when they give the allergy report on the evening news or the morning news, and when mold is high, and when elm and oak and ash and the trees and whatever else grows here in Alabama, pretty much everything. This image is a scanning electron microscope image of pollen grains. Does anything strike you as unusual? I mean, aren't pollen grains just those little flecks that float around in the wind, get caught in your nose, you sneeze out, and all that kind of jazz? But look at the order to each one. Look how they're all similar. All the same pollen has the same structure, and look at how complicated it is. I mean, this is more complicated than many of our manufactured biomolecules. Nanotechnology has not quite gotten to this. Buckyballs, a very famous chemistry term, 60 carbon atoms, I believe, all arranged in this sort of grid. This is what it reminds me of. But yet that's sophomore, junior level chemistry. Look at that little inset, though, the little yellow square. That inset is bacteria. Again, the structure, the diversity. And it's all garbled. That'll teach me to use some fancy new font. On this, I wanted you to make a mental note of what we saw. And I wanted to ask the question, did you see the fingerprint of God? Look real close. It's kind of hard to, you got to find it. It's subtle. It's very subtle. Did you see the fingerprint of design of God when we looked at Saturn? Can we see it when we look at the Earth? Of course we can. And we don't need some big blob that I've thrown up on this image to see that absolutely there is design. Something interesting that Dr. Faust mentioned was Richard Dawkins, how he talked about design and how it's an illusion. I actually was scouring the internet one day, and I watched a debate down in Mexico City. And Richard Dawkins, it was a panel debate. There was three on each side. And he got up, and I was blown away just because I had not heard him say it, being very militant in his atheism. But he said, there absolutely is design, an appearance of design. He said, yeah, I'm not going to deny it. At face value, it looks like nature has design. But he said it's an illusion. And it's about time you grow up out of your naivety. Wow. Well, at least I would give him that his face value, that common sense intuition that was on his lips for a moment, was absolutely correct. You see, in Psalm 19, verse 1, which was read as our scripture reading this morning, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Colossians 1, verse 16 tells us, for by him all things were created, in the heavens and on the earth, invisible and visible. Absolutely. And we can see that when we think about the vastness, the diversity, the detail, the structure of just simple observations. And I say simple observations because these are things that you can go out on the internet. You can look at these images. You can find Saturn and Jupiter and the moons of Jupiter. You can see that there are geysers on the moon Enceladus. And you can see that there are volcanoes on the moon Io. You can see that there are other galaxies that are made of billions of stars that, when we look at our sun, is absolutely amazing. I want to read for you a quote. And I want you to think about this quote as we move to a couple more points as I wrap up the lesson. This quote was by C.S. Lewis in his book, God in the Dock. And I don't have the whole quote. I'm going to read the whole quote, and I'll get to this ending portion that's on the screen. If the solar system was brought about by an accidental collision, then the appearance of organic life on this planet was also an accident. And the whole evolution of man was an accident too. If so, then all our present thoughts are mere accidents. The accidental byproduct of the movement of atoms, and this holds for the thoughts of the materialists and astronomers as well as for anyone else. But if their thoughts, that is, materialism and about astronomy, are merely accidental byproducts, why should we believe them to be true? I see no reason for believing that one accident should be able to give me a correct account of all the other accidents. All right, let's summarize that very quickly. C.S. Lewis said, we are told our universe is an accident. We are a part of that universe. We must be an accident too. But I have thoughts. I've listened to atheists tell me what they think. Those thoughts must be an accident too, if I'm an accident. So C.S. Lewis says, why in the world would we believe the thoughts of an accident and count it as true. I agree. The thoughts we have are part of the design and the intellect given to us by our Creator. Let's focus a moment on a couple of these aspects. I mentioned diversity. And what I mean by diversity is that there is not one single object that populates our entire universe. This is a very famous diagram, and I paired it with a very intriguing verse found in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. In 1 Corinthians 15, Paul is talking about the difference between our physical bodies and our spiritual bodies. He said that there is a physical body, there's also a spiritual body. And in trying to get that across to the church at Corinth, Paul uses an analogy that makes sense to them, and it should to us also. He says, there is one glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars. For one star differs from another star in glory. Is that true? Absolutely. Tonight, when you walk out, there is an incredible planetary alignment that is happening for about the next month. When you walk out tonight, you will see the crescent moon, and you will see two other bright objects, Venus and Jupiter. When you look at those objects in the sky, and you compare them to other objects, Spica, Sirius, Polaris, stars, you will notice one obvious fact. One's bright, some are not. When you look at the constellation Orion, there is a star called Rigel, which is blazingly bright blue. You also see another star called Betelgeuse or Betelgeuse, which is orange. This diagram to the right, developed here in the 20th century, describes and tries to plot all the diversity found just in stars. Nothing else, not planets or asteroids or galaxies, or just stars. And what you see is that some stars are red, some stars are blue, some stars at the top are supergiants. Other stars down in the bottom left are white dwarfs. You see, not every star is the same. They're diverse just in that one object. But also in galaxies. I mentioned that we live in what's called a spiral galaxy, but that's not the only type. This is a very, very simplified version of a way of describing three classes of galaxies. Edwin Hubble put this together. Very famous. On the left side, the fork, the handle part of the fork, are elliptical galaxies, galaxies that are big spherical or maybe football-shaped galaxies. And you notice there's a few different types labeled E0 all the way to E7. Just a way of distinguishing a few. Just give them a different number and letter. Okay, so there's a few different types. Then you see this fork, and the two fork describes two different types of spiral galaxies. Some have just arms that wrap around a nucleus. Other galaxies have this interesting feature called a bar that stretches all the way across the center of the galaxy and connects two spiral arms. Very, very prominent feature, very, very well known. So here we have just a way of describing a few different types of galaxies. Let's expand that a little bit. This is another plot that tries to fill in just a little bit more the diversity found just in galaxies. And this is by far one of the more simplified versions of galaxy classification. Think about detail for a moment. The constellation Orion. We know about the constellation Orion, the three belt stars, probably one of the first that children ever learn or that people are ever able to identify. In Job chapter 38, you find this statement. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades? The Pleiades is another name for the seven sisters, a grouping, a cluster of stars. Or loose the cords of Orion. Can you lead forth the Maseroth in their season? Or can you guide the bear with its children? In this section, the discussion is, do we as humans have control over the constellations, over the groupings of stars, over their motion, over their arrangement? And the rhetorical question is absolutely not. But I want you to focus there on the image for a moment. That's a very maybe common image, one that is familiar to us. But is that all that is there? Think about that question. What is beyond the stars? This is that exact same piece of the sky. But instead of looking at the visual light that our eyes can see, if you look at infrared light coming from this section of the sky, you see that it's filled. It's filled with stuff. And that stuff are various dust grains and gases that are heated by the stars around them so that they glow in just a low sort of heat, infrared light. And you see that there are complexes, that it's not just even across the entire sky, that it's groupings and intense regions. There's an amazing detail, even to the aspects of the universe that we do not see. Have you ever heard the phrase, there is no such thing as a free lunch? Maybe some that are older, absolutely. There's no such thing as a free lunch. What that means is you don't get something for nothing, right? There's something that you have to put forward, whether it's work, whether it's money, whether it's something, in exchange for that meal, that hot plate that you want. Well, that's just cause and effect. And the same principle is true on a universal scale. If we see structure, if we see diversity, if we see detail, if we see elements of design and order, it's not there from nothing. There has to be something. It's not a free lunch. And we need to remind those that would say it was all an accident, we need to remind them that something is required if we see the incredible detail that we have before us. Let's look quickly. The Earth-Sun relationship. We orbit a star, our sun. It comes up every day. It goes down every day. We have 24 hours like clockwork, right? No pun intended. Our sun, it's our constant friend. It heats us. It provides that 1,400 watts per square meter that gives photosynthesis the energy to generate the oxygen that we breathe. It's that warming. It's constant, right? It's always there. Did you notice on the previous image, back up real quick, notice there's spots on the sun. What are those? Well, they're sunspots. Brilliant name. Easy to follow. Those sunspots are regions of the sun that are being distorted by magnetic field. Yes, the sun has an intense magnetic field. And sometimes the magnetic field penetrates the surface and it distorts it. And actually, the center of those spots are 4,000 Kelvin. Incredibly hot. But you see, in the context of 6,000 degrees, they show up as little dark spots. But that is a scale image of our Earth compared to a sunspot. We would fit inside a sunspot. Look at the structure. Look at the wisps and the detail that is just on this distortion on the sun's surface. But notice also very quickly that there are these little specks. It almost looks like there's some sort of sand grain on the image. Those sand grains move because they're not sand grains. What does this image remind you of? Maybe if you're ever in the kitchen and you got something boiling over on the stove, right? You have this boiling and churning pot of water. The sun, which isn't a liquid, is this plasma, actually boils almost. Hot, intense portions of gas bubble up from the millions of degrees at the center, and they expand just like a hot air balloon rises. They heat in the center and they expand, and when they hit the surface, they release. Not pop exactly, but they hit the surface and then begin to spread out. They cool and then they sink back. It's bubbling, it's churning. Is our sun really constant? Well, to some degree, but watch this video for a moment. There's a strange dark disk, and that dark disk is required for this video to be produced. It's called a coronagraph. You block out the sun's light so that you can see the faint light coming around it. That is your sun. That is our star. Popping, exploding, bursting. Look at the timestamp on the bottom. This was just 11 years ago, 2001. Where were you on April 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, 2001? Were you under a bunker? Were you in some sort of nuclear shelter? Because the sun exploding at far many times greater than a nuclear explosion, blasting, bursting huge amounts of material off its surface. Absolutely amazing. Our sun is dynamic. But what about us? Here we sit on planet Earth, 93 million miles away from the sun. But that's really not far enough. Unless we are cocooned in a very special way, and that happens that we are. You see, we have an atmosphere, of course, and we have this ozone layer, right? And you know about the ozone layer, that it blocks ultraviolet light, and that's why there's big controversy of holes in the ozone and things like that. But beyond that, we are surrounded by a force field. Yes, I said it. The Star Trek term came into my lesson. We are surrounded by a force field, and that force field is true. It is a magnetic force field. You see, when the sun explodes off material, that material can reach a million miles an hour. High velocity, high radiation, subatomic particles streaming at our planet. Just like they were in 2001. But you weren't affected. And the reason is because we have a magnetic field that, as these charged particles come streaming at our lonely little planet, this field forces them around us. Now, some do get in. Some do get in. And if you ever have a GPS satellite, there might be a GPS receiver, there might sometime it says, you know, one of your satellites went down and it has to pick up another one. And likely that could be from the sun. But the major effect that we typically see is the aurora borealis. And if you've ever been fortunate enough to see it, I haven't. I've only seen amazing images. But the aurora borealis is the residual effect of the charged particles that have been blown off the sun that interact with our magnetic field, come spiraling down these sort of imaginary lines, and they interact with our atmosphere. And instead of causing radiation and cancer and causing us to go underground, it produces this beautiful, brilliant light show in both the north and the southern hemispheres around the poles. That is the effect that we commonly feel from our dynamic sun. Let's think real quick about our own Earth, and then we'll conclude. In Isaiah 45, verse 18, we read that, "Thus says the Lord who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who has established it, who did not create it in vain, who formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, there is no other." You see, we sit on a planet that was not an accident, that is designed and is especially designed for your habitation. You are designed, you are a complement. The earth is a complement to humanity. What about if you lived on the planet Mercury? What would your life be like? Short. I think I saw someone mouth short. Absolutely. You would have half a day every year. Every time you went around the sun, that would be half a day. And it is 800 degrees on the surface of Mercury. No atmosphere. Don't think about breathing. Just sit there and wait for a moment. Because nighttime comes around, right? And then you get to cool off from that 800 degrees. Cool off to a nice minus 200 degrees. That seems like a very, very nice place for humanity to live. What about Venus, right? Venus is our sister planet. It's roughly the same diameter. It's roughly the same mass as Earth. It has the same amount of gravity. It has mountains. It has valleys. It has an atmosphere, right? But wait a second. I threw up some sort of strange image, kind of dual-natured. I threw this up because commonly you will see two different variations of pictures of Venus. One, on one side is this nice, even cloud tops, little wisps maybe. And the other is the radar image of the surface of Venus. You see, we've never been on the surface of Venus in a manned mission. There has been a lander that has landed on the surface of Venus, and it lasted all of, I think, two pictures. You see, the surface of Venus is the hottest place in the entire solar system outside of the sun. 900 degrees Fahrenheit. It melts lead on the surface of Venus. Not exactly Earth's twin. carbon dioxide, its atmosphere is 100 times more dense. If you went down to the bottom of the ocean, 3,000 feet, you would feel the same pressure as if you were standing on the surface of Venus. What about Mars, right? We've had rovers on Mars for approaching a decade, I believe, scouring the surface of Mars, taking wonderful images, right? Mars, that's where we're going to live next. If the Earth, if we go into a nuclear holocaust, we'll all up and go to Mars. Well, we better do some intense planning if we want to live on Mars. You see, Mars has less, I think it's 1% the atmospheric pressure that we have. It has less than 0.25% oxygen in its thin atmosphere. So if you go, you better take your oxygen with you. If you go, you better take your water with you because there is no liquid water on the surface of Mars. It is drier than the Sahara Desert. So I actually recommend going to the Sahara. You'll live longer. Mars. What about the gas giants, Saturn, Jupiter, Uranus, Neptune? Well, if you go there, you will be embroiled in intense, frigid temperatures, an intense, gaseous atmosphere that will crush you. It's so intense that it actually liquefies hydrogen. I wouldn't suggest going there. What is our conclusion? Our conclusion is that absolutely Psalm 19 verse 1 had it right long ago that the heavens declare the glory of God. God created what we have around us, showed it to us by the design that he put into it, the fingerprint that we can see in the evidence. Romans chapter 1 has been mentioned a couple of times today. Verse 20, since the creation of the world, God, his invisible attributes are clearly seen. Present tense. You can see his invisible attributes right now and understood by his creation, even his eternal power and his Godhead. They are without excuse who deny that. That's what the verse says. You see, when we walk outside, and I encourage you tonight, when you walk outside, take a glimpse of the heavens above you. Because God put them there for signs and seasons, days and years to light our way, to guide our months, to guide our timekeeping, to give us the life-sustaining planet that we live on. And it is absolutely incredible. What is so important about considering that we live on a planet designed for us? Well, two things. It shows to us that life is important in the mind of the Creator. Life is important. I think that's a lesson we can apply in lots of issues, in lots of aspects of life. And the other thing is, if we cherish the planet and we cherish each other, then we will also consider that God cherishes every soul and the gospel is for all. Think about how much is put into our physical universe. It is astounding. But this is our temporary home, right? Jesus said, I go to prepare a place for you. And where I go, you know also. How much care and preparation is God putting into preparing heaven? Those rooms, those mansions for those who will obey him. You see, God has laid it out that we can see him in creation. And when we turn to God's word, which matches what we see in creation, tells us the way to get to the next creation, the next habitation for humanity. You see, if we believe in God, as the verses say, if we repent of our sins, as Luke 13 verse 3, Acts 2:38 tells us, if we say Jesus Christ is absolutely the Son of God and we are willing to contact his blood in baptism, if we are willing to be immersed, if we are willing to live out our lives faithful to the Creator, he says that the next creation will be all the better and it can be ours. And I invite you as we stand and as we sing.